My guest this week is the 11th Duke of Richmond, Charles Henry Gordon Lennox. He's best known for founding the Goodwood Festival of Speed and the Goodwood Revival, which is so much fun. We went a couple of years ago and it's incredible. And he's a very lovely man and I'm so pleased to talk to him. Here's Charles. Oh, Charles, hi. How are you?
Hi, I'm really well, thanks, Sweetie. Yeah, very, very nice to be with you.
And how was the Festival of Speed last week?
Gosh, no, well, it was good. I mean, it's hard to believe it was a week ago now. God, it's and we're frantic now, taking it all down, of course. But no, it was an amazing experience to have everyone here again. 150,000 people came.
Wow!
See everyone together. Everyone smiling. Everyone's so happy to see each other. No, it was really a moving thing. No, it was fantastic.
I bet. Got 150,000 came.
150,000 people came. Yeah, wow. Yeah. We were allowed 75%. We had a pilot. It was a pilot event, so we were very grateful to have that. That was really amazing, and everyone worked very hard to make that happen. And everybody came. I mean, I was amazed. I thought, well, it's going to be so complicated for people. Maybe they won't come.
Did they have to do COVID tests or prove that they'd been vaccinated?
Exactly.
Lateral flow,
okay. Or double vax. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you double vaxed?
I've double vaxed with you. Yeah.
Yes, so have I. I'm very happy to hear it. I think everyone should double vax.
Yeah, no,
it's the new in thing, Charles.
It's the new thing. Yeah, God.
But it must have been, because now last year, did you do, you couldn't do any of them, could you?
No, we missed it completely. So it was a pretty traumatic
goodness.
Year for us. So we just had the whole year kind of removed, really. So we'd sold all the tickets. So most of the people that came this year already got tickets. So we'd already sold all the tickets. And everyone was very patient and incredibly supportive. They kind of, you know, hung on in there helped us get it done. So, yeah, and we had a thing called Speed Week in the autumn last year, which brought together Festival Speed and Revival into one sort of crazy kind of digital event.
And amazing.
That was really, that was 26 hours of live TV or something, but with obviously no crowd. But that went well. But it was very different. We like people. We like having people here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Lee and I came to the Revival in 2019, the year before the horribleness began.
Exactly. Our last event, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And the amazing thing to me, because it was the first time we'd ever been, as you know, and you'd very kindly invited us. And I was just blown away by how amazing the people are. They really get into the spirit of it. Everyone dresses up, because I thought, oh, no, probably nobody will dress up. There'll be a few odd bods, but everyone does, don't they?
Yeah, it's amazing. I think you feel pretty uncomfortable now if you don't make some effort. And everyone looks amazing. All right. And everyone does their own thing. It's become a sort of, you know, it's a massive, well, we want it to be a, you know, a really different experience and a huge,
I think it is,
sort of secondhand vintage. We want it to be the biggest secondhand event in the world.
Yeah, well, I think you've got it probably.
Yeah, no, it's exciting. We've got lots of plans for this year. So all those old cars and all the, you know, everything is repurposed, reused, recycled.
Yeah. That's my favourite, I think. I mean, there were amazing outfits. People really went. I mean, I dug out my 1940s jacket and, you know, did a kind of 40s thing. But my favourite was a whole family down to a kind of six-month-old baby. And they were all dressed up in 1960s clothes. It was absolutely brilliant.
Now you see them pushing, you get the nanny. We've had the nannies all, you know, the nanny comes dressed as a sort of Norland nanny and the baby's in a, in a silver cross pram and carrying the picnic hampers and,
it's,
they've come in the right car. No, it's amazing how everyone feels. I think the sort of thing we hadn't ever anticipated was just how it makes everyone feel that they're in it. They're all part of it. They're all doing something. They're all contributing, and that makes everyone feel very different, I think, about it.
That's very and the happiness. It was like I remember going to see Paul McCartney at Wembley or Earls Court or wherever he was, and you could feel the love in that auditorium. And that was the same feeling I felt at the revival. There was kind of a, it was like a happiness thing in the air. I mean, it was a beautiful day.
Yeah, it was a sunny day,
if you remember,
wasn't it?
Yeah. It was gorgeous. But there was a kind of happiness vibe going everywhere. It was amazing. You don't experience, as I say, I remember it at a Paul McCartney concert, but it was that same feeling, which is extraordinary.
You're right, it is a strong feeling. And the first time we did it, it was weird. Nobody wanted, so it was, God, 98 now, a long time ago, but there was this feeling that nobody wanted to go home afterwards. You know, no one wanted to cross the threshold into the real world again.
Into the real world. I'd say it's a place you think, I'd like to live here
I'd
forever.
Like to stay here for a while. And people definitely behave differently. What's great, the moment people dress up like that and make a bit of an effort and look great, they've got their suits on or whatever it is, and they all, you know, and they've had their hair done, and they, you know, everybody behaves. They're very nice to each other. They're very polite and kind. And it's interesting.
Well, I had the great honour that, because you asked me to judge the outfits, which was really
Absolutely,
hard because there were so many wonderful ones. It was really hard. We picked the best woman, didn't we, and the best man.
Exactly.
And they were, they just knocked me sideways. It was absolutely brilliant. Anyway, have you got your cup of tea?
I have.
I forgot to ask you.
I'm very keen on my tea.
Are you a big tea drinker?
I am. I am. I like it with a slice of lemon to you,
Okay. I've got a lemon and ginger, actually. But in the morning, I like my builder's tea. Well, actually, it's not. It's posh builder's, because I do a mixture of English breakfast and Earl Grey.
Okay, yeah, I'm a big Earl Grey fan, I have to say. Yeah.
And I put milk and honey in. But but in the afternoon, I like me herbal. So you were saying, the first time you did the revival was in 1998?
98, yeah, absolutely.
Was it your idea? Was it your kids?
Well, it all started because, my grandfather built the circuit in 1948. It was the first track to open after the war. And then I tried to get it going again when I came back to live at Goodwood in the kind of early 90s. And it was pretty obvious that it wasn't going to happen. So because we had to get planning permission to reopen it, and there was a lot of resistance locally because of noise and things. And so that became very, very challenging. And then we thought, what could we do? Well, how could we try it all out? So then we had the idea for the Festival Speed as a bit of a tryout, really, for the circuit, and that was in '93, and we learned a hell of a lot doing that. So eventually, we did get permission to reopen the track 7 years later. So it was a 7-year negotiation. It was a long time, and then when we did it, we suddenly thought, well, actually, the real USP of this place is it's never been changed. So even though all the buildings had sort of pretty much fallen down and stuff, the actual track itself, if you like, the real core soul of the place was still completely as it was.
So that track that I saw on the revival where those lovely old minis and cars, that's the original track?
That's exactly as it was the day it was built. Yeah, so your lap times are exactly, you can compare them against Jim Clark and Jackie Stewart and Fangio and all those great drivers. So that's untouched. So we then thought, well, maybe... we should try and put the buildings back. We'll put all those wartime buildings back and try and make it feel like it felt in the 50s. So we then did that.
Amazing.
And then we got on to, let's encourage people to come driving 50s and 60s cars as well. And then some bright spark said, why don't we go the whole way, get one to dress as well? And then a lot of people thought that was a really bad idea. So we had quite a lot of resistance to that. And then we thought, we'll just do it anyway. And it took everyone a couple of years. And then everyone, got more and more and more enthusiastic about it, and now, as you know, if you don't make some sort of effort, you're going to feel a bit uncomfortable.
I thought it was a brilliant thing.
So it was a lucky thing. Yeah.
So were you always a car fanatic?
I was, I'm afraid.
Because of your granddad.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. So I used to come and stay here as a child. When I was about 8, he used to send me all the magazines at school, and he'd take me around the paddock. He had me meet all the drivers, and there was a cocktail party here always. So Easter Monday was the big meeting at Goodwood, so all the big drivers were here for that bank holiday weekend, Easter weekend. And in those days, they didn't race on a Sunday, so they had practice on Saturday, took the Sunday off. They all got so plastered on the Saturday night, they had to take the Sunday off. And then
that's hysterical.
And then the Monday they were racing, and Easter Monday was the big day. So he'd take me around to meet everybody, and I absolutely loved it. So when he closed in 66, I was absolutely mortified. as a small boy.
Why did he close it? Was it just too much to run?
Yeah,
or?
No, the cars, he'd done well with it, actually. So it wasn't that. I think the cars were changing pretty rapidly. So they were putting wings on Formula One cars and they were getting very, very quick. He didn't like that much. He didn't like the way it was being run by the sort of club that managed it. And anyway, he was just, I don't know, he got fed up with it, I guess, and decided to shut it, which was actually, it was probably a great thing. You know, looking back on it, it was probably a good decision because it meant it all stayed the same. Otherwise, it would have been developed, you know, they would have had to change the track to suit the cars, and that would have changed the track completely because the cars were getting so much faster. The track would have got tighter to slow the cars up. So it's incredibly quick now, really fast track. Because it's just untouched.
Can you drive a racing car?
Yeah, I drive a bit. Yeah, drive on it. Yeah.
Do you?
Ooh. Yeah.
Is it scary?
We love it. No, we all love it. When I was, back in the 70s and things, we used to just turn it because it was all nothing happening down there. You just turn up with a car and belt round for a few hours. It was really good fun.
Every teenager's dream,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely fantastic.
That's hysterical.
Smashed a few cars up.
I bet you did. Yeah. I think I told you actually when we came to Goodwood that. In the 60s, because I was kind of discovered in 66 when that all finished.
Big year.
Well, for me it was. And I think I told you, I think it was 1960, I didn't even drive, 67, 68. We had a Lamborghini Miura.
You told me, so
it was
cool, yeah.
Acid lime green with an orange racing stripe.
That's as good as it gets, Twiggy, I know.
I know. I should have kept, I mean.
You really should.
I really wasn't into cars. I didn't drive. And it was sold. We sold it about...
So who bought it?
I don't know. But I think about 3 years ago, somebody contacted us and said that it was coming up for sale somewhere for some ridiculous sum of money. And they wanted to verify that it was my car. And
how brilliant. But you were just... So you never drove it? You just sat in it as a passenger, did you?
Never drove it, no. No.
You've driven around in it a bit.
For about 2 years. Yeah. Bit scary. And very low down, I remember.
Oh, they're wonderful. That was the world's first supercar, really.
Was it?
Yeah. Mid-engine.
I know when we drove along the street, people used to stop and just look at it.
Yeah, beautiful thing. Yeah, beautiful thing. And they're always in those great colours, lime green, orange, bright orange. Yeah. Yeah, no.
Amazing.
Seth Relly lived in his. It wasn't a Miura. He had an Espada, which is a little bit bigger. But he loved it so much. I remember reading a book about. I think it was Barbara Sutherland, the opera singer.
Uh-huh.
And he directed her a lot, and they were at La Scala or something, and he sort of parked the car outside the opera house and just that's where he spent the night.
That's hysterical. I must ask Lee because. Lee did a film with him, his first film.
Oh, really? Go on.
Zeffirelli. Yeah, they did Brother, Son, Sister, Moon in Italy. But that was back in the mid-70s, I think. So I don't know whether it's the
this
same.
Would have been a bit before, this would have been, yeah, actually, it's a bit before then.
So when I was reading your biography, I was amazed because it said when your mum and dad moved into Goodwood, it was in dust sheets and it needed a lot of work and it was really run down. And I think there was a little quote saying that lots of houses in that period were the big grand houses. Was that because after the war there was no money? And
exactly. I think the whole sort of psyche, I think everyone had changed that. I don't think anyone believed after the war that they'd move back. Not just into the houses, but that lifestyle.
Lifestyle. Well, it changed, didn't it?
And it didn't really exist anymore. And a lot of people that could afford to maintain and live in those sorts of houses just didn't. They just didn't. They felt they couldn't. They felt they couldn't do it. My grandparents never loved living here that much anyway. So it was only opened up for the horse racing and the car racing.
So did they live somewhere else most of the time, and then just
they were in London a lot of the time. Here at weekends a bit and things. But no, actually, to be fair, they did live here during the war. But the army were here a lot.
Oh, well, because that happened a lot, didn't it?
And it was a hospital for a lot of the time too, yeah.
Yeah. When was it built?
So it was really built over quite a long period. So the earliest bit of the house is the 17th century, and then most of it was built in the 18th century, and some of it was finished in the 19th century. So
it's a gorgeous house, and where it sits is magnificent, isn't it? But so, and also, there's the tradition in your family that when the son becomes 40... they move into the big house, yeah?
It's not a tradition so much. It is a bit, I mean, I think it's just that the plan is that so many of these places, the old boy would leave the house feet first and, that would be it. So I think I think my father was very, very keen to make sure that, we were both young enough. He was young enough to have a life still, and that I was young enough and had some energy to
take it on.
Yeah. And I think it was a good plan.
Well, but you knew it was coming up.
Yeah, so I'd known forever it was coming up. And I was doing something entirely, I wasn't here at all. I was in sort of, very involved in a completely different world at that point. So I came back to Goodwood, and got more and more involved.
Is this to do with your photography?
Exactly,
I
was doing all
that's your big, big passion, isn't it?
Exactly, I was very involved in very involved in film photography, exactly. And then, applied some of that, I guess, in a funny way, applied some of that to what goes on here, yeah.
So did you left, you went to Eton, right?
For about a week, yeah. Not for very long.
For about a week. You left at 17 and went to work with Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah,
wow.
I was so lucky. I know it was manna from heaven, actually, because I hadn't loved school much. So and I really wanted to go and I wanted to get into that world. And then I met some guys who were the first students at the National Film School. And I did quite a lot with them, but I was much, much younger than they were. I mean, they were like in their 20s. I was, 17 or something. And then one of them taught me quite a lot, actually, and is a very good filmmaker now. He made The Sessions. Do you remember? Do you see The Sessions?
That really
interesting film.
Yes, yeah. I did.
Called Ben Lewin. And they heard about this job going with Stanley. So I sort of rang up and all a bit crazy, really. And then, it was sort of doing pre-production stills things. It wasn't, but it was just fascinating because it was just only really him and Ken Adams around at that time.
Brilliant. Was this Barry Lyndon?
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
So fantastic at 17 to be around somebody, even just around somebody like that a little bit to experience that sort of just no compromise of anything, unless it was all, had to be like 100%, totally controlled, meticulously planned. Everything was, total dedication, 24 hours a day, focus on everything. It was a very, I think, a good lesson at that age to see that you just need to put in time and effort if you want to get stuff, if you want
but
a result.
You're certainly one of the great film directors ever, anyway.
I loved the exhibition at the Design Museum. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. Was it amazing?
Fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, everyone said we should go and we never got there.
Very good.
But did you get to know him as a man or was it
he was
too
very nice
kind
to
of...
me. Because we used to spend every evening with him. We were working with him and Ken Adams, who was a great art director.
Yeah, brilliant.
The greatest, really. And they'd just go through all the pictures and say what was relevant, what wasn't, and that I'd shot. And because they were just looking for the right details and the right locations and things.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was very helpful. He was a very, very good photographer. I think he was a photographer on Look magazine when he was 15 or something.
Was he
given a camera, but very early. So he started off, actually, that's what he was a photographer to start with. Then he got into making short films and the rest, as they say, is history. But he was very nice and often giving, good hints about, well, if you try and do it like this, it might come out next time. So he was very, he wasn't, because he was famous for being quite, quite short with
people.
He was famous,
he was quite spiky, wasn't he, apparently.
Anyway, he was very nice to me always and very friendly, yeah.
I never met him, sadly, but I wish I had. But, I had the same kind of relationship with Ken Russell, who I did my first film with. And, lots of people said he was mad and he was crazy and horrible, and he was wonderful to me.
Exactly, that was such a great film, yeah.
But, I saw another side of him and he was wonderful and always kind. And well, I always look upon him as my mentor. So do you think Kubrick was a bit of your mentor,
it's a bit grand to say that. I would love to think so, but I mean, I was nobody and he was I think what had a massive effect on me was just being around, just seeing someone where compromise wasn't in there, being around someone where there was just no compromise and was capable of pulling all those people together as a leader and making something massive, the scale of everything was, I think in that sense, it did have a big effect. It was a very impressionable age.
Yeah, because actually you're right, because I always thought with Ken, because in the end, every decision had to come back to him. as it would have done with Kubrick. I mean, it's major. Every there's always somebody who needs something, who wants something, who wants answers to a question. The lighting, the costumes, the actors, the everything.
Yeah.
And it's all ends up in there, which is a little bit, as you said, it was good training for you, because I should think running what you run, in the end, they all come to you, don't they?
Well, I mean, I get the whole thing about management nowadays is they're not meant to, you know, you're meant to be able, everyone's meant to, you know, you're meant to kind of empower people, which is all very commendable and vital if you're going to get stuff done. But actually then all those great directors, they didn't really, they just made every decision. I remember everyone saying with Stanley, he ordered the buns at break time, literally. So.
What bun do you want today?
Yeah,
dear?
Exactly.
So you're because you are a brilliant photographer, and that was that your first kind of working goal to do photography? And
I guess it was, really. That's what I've. It's weird.
I mean,
now,
you still do
so
that,
long.
Don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, no, I'm still, you still do a lot. Yeah, I still do quite a bit. And you know, I started when I was 12, and I'm now 66. So that's quite a weird.
Who gave you your first camera?
My first camera, my father did. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, my grandfather was very. He bought me my first enlarger and all darkroom kit.
Oh, so
I
you do you can do all that printing
yeah.
and.
Well, I don't
amazing.
Do it so much anymore because we live in a digital world, sadly. But
oh, that's true. Yeah, do you, I find that sad actually? I mean, when I modelled in the 60s, everything I can remember doing shoots, and then getting in the car when they were printed and driving out to. Somewhere along the A40 to the lady who did the retouching, and
oh, yeah.
she'd do it all with brushes and razors, you know, little things just to retouch. I mean,
yeah, incredible. No, the skill was incredible. I mean, I
they were amazing.
I mean, I shouldn't really say that. Sadly, it's like it's but I think there's lots of good. I mean, the digital world is an exciting world, but the sort of the joy of the fact that the photo that you know one felt that the photo never lied.
Mm.
Which of course it did, but you know, there was a magic about photography where you look at something and you couldn't believe how it was done because you knew that it was real. You know, you couldn't. Whereas now, of course, you look at something and you see that something's upside down or doing something weird, and you think, well, they've just done that with Photoshop or something. Same with the movies, really. The sort of special effects world has been slightly the magic of that. I think has been slightly destroyed, and that for me, photography is so wonderful in that sense that it always felt so. It's always real. You can't. And that's where those retouchers were amazing because they did it, you said, with brushes and dyes.
Yeah, unbelievable. And also the animation world, you know, when you think that all the old animated films were literally hand-drawn. But you've had quite a lot of exhibitions around the world, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I've been lucky to. Yeah, I have. I've had a few. Yeah. Not many in the last 18 months, annoyingly.
I know.
Yeah.
So how did you get through the last... I've asked everyone this.
Yeah.
It's been... When it hit, it was just so unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big shock, yeah. It was a big shock.
And what did you know immediately... Because it happened in the March. Did you know immediately then that all your summer plans were going to go belly up?
it was about... Yes, there was a weird sort of... week or two of realization that suddenly this was a bit more serious than, you know, suddenly it was an item on the news that was being mentioned, and then it was the headlines, and then it was, well, this is, and I got COVID in March, actually.
Did you? That first March?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
From my doctor.
From your doctor?
Yeah.
Oh, I shouldn't laugh.
I know. I went for my annual medical checkup and he gave me COVID.
Oh, my goodness. Did he? Obviously, he didn't know he had it.
No. He was very apologetic. He rang me and said, how are you feeling? I said, I'm not feeling very good. He said, well, I hate to tell you, but I think I've got COVID.
Did you have to go to hospital?
No, I was fine. It was pretty mild. I was, five days of bit of a fever. Yeah, in bed a bit. And I suppose I felt a bit tired for a couple of weeks, but I was fine. Yeah.
Well, thank God. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So, I mean, you've got, you know, your festivals you do, and then you've got a farm and you do farm produce. And what did you did you have to close everything down? I mean, what do you do in that?
Well, we
when
did,
you're running something that big,
Pretty much we had to shut a lot of it down. We kept the farm going, so all the things we could keep running, and which the guys could keep, you know, keep working mm-hmm. at, we obviously kept going. So the farm became, whereas it was really a wholesale food business before. So we have a lovely organic farm.
I know you do. And you've got that lovely shop in Chichester.
Exactly. You've got a lovely shop.
That sells the produce.
Yeah. And so the shop became much, well, most of our produce is going to wholesale. It then became much more retail, which we kept going. So now you can come to the farm and buy all the stuff.
I say, have you got a farm shop on the estate?
Yeah.
Fabulous.
It just sells our stuff, but it's, so that's gone okay. But the hotel and the restaurants, the kennels and all our restaurants, we've got this wonderful restaurant which only sells produce off the farm.
Mm-hmm. Is that in the hotel, the restaurant?
Yeah. Wow. Farm Butch Chef. So that all that had to stop. And obviously the events all stopped and people going around the house stopped and all the, you know, events in the house stopped and all the weddings stopped. And so we'd really just lost a whole year. I mean, we just lost a whole year of revenue. So it was a bit of a shock.
So when were you able to kick off again the year we're in
exactly
now?
When we were allowed to open again. So the hotel's just, you know, we've just reopened all of that, and we've just, as we said, we've just done Festival Speed as a pilot event, and we've got the big horse race meeting coming up in 2 weeks.
That's right. You do the horse racing the big, as well.
Yeah, we've got
you?
What we call Glorious Goodwood, the Cattle Goodwood Festival's in 2 weeks, and then we got Revival. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. When do you sleep, Charles?
Well, the horse racing is a bit of a marathon. It's five. That's 5 days on the trot. So.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So strictly no.
And do you go every day? You're there every day.
Yeah, we do.
And do people come in from all over the world? Well, can they come in at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. They would know. Well, it's difficult. So all travel's a bit difficult.
Yeah.
And Qatar are our big partners, and we're a bit worried that, you know, I think Qatar's on the red list at the moment, so that looks a bit difficult.
Yeah.
But that's an amazing thing. I mean, there's been horse racing up there since 1801.
Oh my goodness.
In exactly the same place, same time of year. Always the sort of last moment, the sort of social calendar.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
And yeah, well, it was. And it's still got all those traditions, and it was always very kind of much more relaxed than Ascot. Edward VII sort of made it what it is, really. And he started wearing linen suits and Panama hats and stuff. And that's what really made it much softer. And so it's a real sort of England in the summer at its best.
Yeah. I mean, your history, I mean, I know little bits about it, but we got hold of a series from the BBC called The Sceptred Isle.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the history of Great Britain from Julius Caesar up until, I think, 2000. Absolutely fabulous. I think it was done in the 90s. Yeah. And Anna Massey narrates it brilliantly. And we through lockdown, every time we went out in the car, we'd listen to, because it's endless. It's like 50 hours of broadcasting because it's the whole history. And the Duke of Richmond's name comes up a lot through all the, it was like, gosh, oh, that must be Charles's great, 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 great. It must be. How far back can you trace your family?
Well, there've been a few incarnations of it.
So, have there?
Yeah. So this incarnation is from the Stuarts, from Charles II.
So what year is that?
So Charles II, this is sort of late 17th century. He was born, the first Duke was the son of Charles II, illegitimate son of Charles II, and Louise de Querouaille, who was his French mistress. She was a French spy.
How exciting. Yeah. That's amazing. How brilliant. So what do you mean different, they were different strains of the family?
Well, they die out. Yes, exactly. No, well, they weren't the same family at all. So if you like these titles, are kind of, it's all a bit mad, but they're held by the sovereign and they're dished out at various, so if they die out, they're then taken back
then
again.
Then somebody else gets given
dish it out again to somebody else. Exactly.
Wow. And have you done lots of research into your family history? I mean, or has somebody else done it? Or
there's quite a lot. I guess there's a certain amount out there. You know, it's a certain amount known already. There was a very interesting BBC drama, actually, called The Aristocrats. Have you ever saw that?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Which is based on a book by Stella Tilliard, the American historian. And that was about the third Duke, actually. So that was sort of middle of the 18th century. And he was the one that really built the house and the race course and stuff, but him and his sisters, who were all very, very interesting. Especially the girls were fascinating. They were all very interesting, but these sisters were really high achievers, very interesting. So, yeah.
How amazing. It is amazing because I did one, you know, that program, Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah, yeah.
And that I did well, because I was desperate to do it because I knew nothing about my, I was hoping that somewhere in the past there'd be a castle somewhere, but there wasn't.
There probably was, you just haven't found it.
No, there wasn't. And so it was brilliant. And they kind of only do, because they come and ask you if you want to do it, because lots of people turn it down. I don't know why, because I was desperate to do it. And because my mum and dad didn't really talk, I think that generation who came through the war, my mum would never talk about the past, or it was all like, oh, that was horrible, and, you know, and her sister died very young. So we didn't really talk, you know, I didn't know anything about it. And my backstory was quite sad, really, because my great-great-great-grandmother, you know, ended up in the workhouse. She had, like, five children. Her husband had run off. You know, he probably couldn't cope, you know, because there was nobody to help them in those days.
So tough.
But she must have been quite a woman, because she did go to jail for a year for passing coins, which apparently they used to get women to do it because they were fake coins, and then they would get the change back or something. Anyway, and the big guys never got caught, so they caught the little people, and she went to jail. And when she came out, the next time they found her in the census, she was running a boarding house and renting rooms to policemen. And her daughter married a young policeman.
Oh, great.
So, I mean,
she was obviously
a great entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Amazing. So, I mean, I found that incredibly. So when you look back to your history, it must be extraordinary, all the people that, you know, no big scandals.
No big scandals. Mostly nice stories. The first Duke was fairly flamboyant, and he married his son off to cover a gambling debt of his, which he couldn't afford to pay. So he married his son off to this rich property guy, and the children didn't like each other at all. They were only 15 and 13 or something at the time.
Oh my goodness!
And the boy went off on the grand tour around Europe. He met everybody in Europe that he ought to meet. After a couple of years, he came home and he met his best friend at the opera in The Hague on the way home. And they had a nice night out. And he fell in love with the girl in the box opposite during the opera. And asked who it was, and it was his wife.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, which is a nice story. And they lived very happily ever after and had... They didn't have that many children, but she was... pregnant many, many, many times. Yeah, lost lots of children, actually. But it's a nice story, yeah.
It is. And you've got five children, right?
I've got five children, yeah.
Wow. Do they all live at home? Or they? No, you must have some, I've met them.
Yeah, no, they're all the youngest. I've got twins at the end who are 21.
That's right.
And the oldest is 36, yeah.
They're not at home, presumably.
The twins are at uni. All the rest are, yeah. On and off.
And how did they cope through the lockdown? Was their uni shut down? Did they come home?
Yeah, no, they were there and not there. And I think they did really well, actually, but jolly difficult. I mean, that generation's really had it tough.
My heart, you know, it was horrible for everybody. And we, you know, we didn't get sick and we were together. So it wasn't, I just missed seeing my daughter and my stepson and the kids, the baby, you know, our grandchildren.
Exactly.
But, you know, we were fine. But I will say to Lee, my heart goes when it used to go, well, still does, to teenagers, because that's the time when you want to mix and mingle and fall in love and fall out of love and just hang out. And they couldn't do that.
No, I think it's been really, really tough. I think they've really paid the price. Yeah, no, not good.
Are they back? They're back now, though.
Yeah, they're not. They're on summer holidays at the moment.
Oh, yes. Broken up. Yeah. What do they want to? What do they want to do? All different, I suppose.
All different, yeah, exactly, all different. But a couple of them working. One's about to go to America to do go to uni in America, and
lovely.
And then the little boy is he's a bit of a singer songwriter, so he's a bit keen on on his music. Which is Chris Evans stuck him on the Chris Evans show the other morning, which is quite funny.
Oh, that's nice.
So he played out the Chris Evans show, which was fun.
That's brilliant. That's huge. Yeah. That is. That's absolutely. Was he excited?
He was. He was relaxed about it, but yeah.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Really nice.
So, so the revival's going to happen this year.
We hope so too. Yeah, we're full on. We're going to go to. Yeah, we hope 100% revival. Absolutely.
Oh, 100%.
Hope
so.
Oh
my goodness.
Yeah, and we've got some big plans. We're doing a big Festival of Britain kind of celebration. In terms of
this year.
Yeah, in terms of the set build and everything.
Wow.
And then a big Stirling Moss celebration, and well, lots of fun things because we build all those crazy sets, and
I know
we got some fun stuff.
It was incredible. Have you had all the big drivers there over the years? I mean, Jackie Stewart.
Yeah.
And
Jackie's been lots, yeah. And Jackie's
the only racing driver I knew was Jochen Rindt, who sadly died in a terrible car crash.
Terrible,
but
yeah.
That was back in, 1970-something. And he was such a lovely guy. But I didn't really know any of the other ones. It was just him that we met.
One of the greats. His widow's been a few times here.
Nina?
Yeah,
she was gorgeous.
She's lovely,
she was
yeah.
beautiful yeah. girl. So I kind of, when that happened, I was so upset that I kind of didn't really follow racing after that for a while. But I have to say, walking around Goodwood in 2019 and looking at all the old cars, I thought, oh, it was quite emotional and lovely.
Yeah, cars are a bit like music. I think they kind of cars represent certain moments in your life in a way.
They do, they do.
You remember?
I just wish I'd have hung on to mine. I mean, I think I had probably the first automatic Mini in England because they made it for me. And I couldn't drive a Garrett. They had to make me an automatic. And I asked for it in dark purple. It was gorgeous. It was dark purple with dark purple tinted windows and tan leather interior. It was gorgeous.
Is it still around?
God only knows. I mean, I sold that to buy a little, you know, the little sweet little Mercedes Sports.
Oh yeah, great.
Which I loved. I loved that car. And then when you start having kids, you need bigger cars, don't you? But if only I'd have kept all of them.
I bet it's around somewhere. I bet someone's got it somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Anyone out there with a purple Mini tinted windows? It was mine. Well, when I went to Japan in 1968, Toyota, I didn't drive. Toyota gave me their new sports model. I can't remember what it was called. And they shipped it to the UK for me.
Oh.
But I couldn't drive that either. Oh, they're out there somewhere,
yeah.
Presumably. Well, listen, it's been so lovely of you to take time to talk to me because I know how busy you are. And it's been lovely.
Absolute pleasure to you.
And I'll keep everything crossed that it all goes ahead in
September. Yeah, thanks. And we hope you'll come.
Well, if I get an invite, I hope we will.
It's on its way. Lovely to see you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to be involved. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Ah, oh, that was lovely. He's such a lovely man, Charles. And what he does at Goodwood is incredible. And don't forget, the Goodwood Revival this year is the 17th to the 19th of September. So get your tickets. It's really good fun. The family absolutely have a great day out. So see you there. Bye. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
Just heard a Stripped Media production.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.